Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning and happy Friday. So a lot going on around the country, including this really wild headline that you may or may not have heard about from ABC. Two Chinese nationals have been charged with allegedly smuggling into the United States a fungus, which scientific literature classifies as a potential agroterrorism weapon, the Justice Department said Tuesday. So they are looking at this, and apparently these two Chinese nationals have said that they were part of the University of Michigan, and so they are allegedly receiving Chinese government funding for their research, some of it at the University of Michigan. And this begs the question, of course, how exactly was this stopped? And this wouldn't be necessarily a regular, search as part of border control, all of that. But this comes in the midst of the whole immigration debate, the whole visa debate, and a lot of interesting commentary back and forth from different Republicans who are kind of, I think, trying to play the game a little bit and not necessarily offend the Democrats. And one of those, which, I'm sitting here thinking, well, why not? Like, you have the majority, just go for it. But one of those is Senator John Cornyn, who is, of course, facing a primary challenge from current sitting Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. And Paxton is up about 22 points in the latest poll. Neither of them, by the way, have Trump's endorsement, which I also find fascinating, because if Trump were to endorse, I think that would tip the scale, certainly if he were to endorse Paxton. But let's welcome in Tony Ortiz, who is the founder of Current Revolt. And Tony, Cornyn posted an X post that was, talking about, student visas, and we got to be careful and, all of this, making sure that we're not deporting the wrong people and all this stuff. And I find this just so utterly nonsensical to not just support President Trump and his efforts to clearly be America first and to deport the people that deserve deportation. Why not focus on that instead of kind of trying to pull it back and sort of play both sides here? I find Cornyn's rhetoric probably not landing with a lot of the Texas conservatives.
Yeah, well, you actually hit right on it. So he's facing a primary challenge, and because of this, he has to appeal to a specific demographic. And again, you hit on this right when you were talking about it. Like, this is his rhetoric is something that appeals to Democrats, and so it may look like this is a strategy for Cornyn to get some Democrats that are in Texas. It's pretty common for Democrats to vote in Republican primaries, to get some crossover there where he can get not only the moderate vote, but he also gets the Democrats that vote in the Republican primary to earn their vote when he's saying things like, well, the Trump administration is going after these Chinese students and I'm not really a fan of it, right? I think that may be a strategy for him.
Yeah, and so, from your position in Texas and all that, and looking at the politics in Texas that I think are really fascinating. We can, dive a little deeper into this. It doesn't seem like Cornyn is coming from a position of appealing to the base, certainly not the MAGA base, but certainly not from looking at the last election in Texas, that those legislators who went for Ken Paxton's, ridiculous sham of an impeachment were primaried. I mean, we have recent history of some of these incumbents getting ousted when they're not standing up as genuine conservatives. So why wouldn't this concern him a little bit, or is he just kind of that oblivious?
Yeah, I think that, you know, he's coming from a weakened position where he's been known to be a moderate for an incredibly long time. And Attorney General Ken Paxton, who's now his opponent, is known to be an incredibly strong conservative. And now Cornyn is so deep into being a moderate that he doesn't have the ability to kind of swing and try to pretend to be a conservative so quickly. So he has no choice, I think, from a strategic perspective, to just be that moderate with a slight conservative appeal in hopes that he gets Democrat crossover, he gets enough moderates to turn over, right? And as you said at the beginning of the show, like at the beginning of the segment, you know, his polling numbers are horrible. And the most recent poll shows that he's down 9 points behind Ken Paxton. And in a race where Wesley Hunt gets in, theoretically, he's still behind, with Ken Paxton still leading the charge. So Paxton's, you know, obviously got a huge support base. He's got a lot of wins on his record with what he's done here in Texas as an attorney general. And I think Cornyn's just going to really struggle.
Well, and that'll be interesting to see if others, you mentioned, you know, Wesley Hunt do enter the race, and then there's kind of this split. But as we mentioned as well, Trump has not provided an endorsement. I don't know if he's kind of waiting a little bit till the last minute, but that does that surprise you? Because, you know, he's currently having to work with Cornyn, who's a current member of the Senate. But Ken Paxton has been a longtime friend and ally. And so to not endorse Paxton, you know, I don't think is a reflection at all on the nature of that friendship, but more, frankly, politicking.
Yeah, absolutely. He's still got to work with, you know, Cornyn. He's still got to get votes passed, still got to get legislation passed. So he's just kind of, it's to me, it seems like he's just kind of staying out of it for now. I imagine as the polling tightens more in favor for Paxton, that you may see Trump come out and just flat out endorse him, or at least give it a little bit more favorable rhetoric towards Paxton. But right now, it, like what you said, he's just playing the politics.
Well, so with this race, and I think that this will be a big focal point nationally for a primary. I mean, obviously, you know, Senate races tend to be, but especially something that is this high profile, at least among Republicans. What about some of the other races in Texas and, you know, overall kind of that just the state, I think, politically is quite fascinating right now when Republicans clearly need to keep and expand majorities in on the federal level, also need to, you know, have better conservatives, I think, in the state legislature, of course. But then you have somebody like Representative Jasmine Crockett, who is now, like, you know, a prime spokesperson for the Democrat Party. I kind of laugh at that and think, really, that's the best you got. But she seems to be coming from a position in a very interesting district. When she had no challenger, actually, in her race, which I find kind of bizarre. And so, you know, she is the incumbent. She now has a challenger. How do you see that race?
I see it as a complete waste of time for Republicans, just to be completely boldly honest. Like, it's a plus 30 Democrat district in a Republican, in a Trump election season, right? And so, you know, Crockett and her district's demographic, they're going to vote for her no matter what. She can do literally anything, and that district is going to vote for her. So, you know, I hate to be kind of negative Nancy here, but for Republicans to spend any money currently, or at least this cycle, on that district to try to unseat her is a complete waste of donations for constituents' time and money and effort, and labor is better spent in districts that are winnable. I think Crockett's got it no matter what.
Well, and that's unfortunate, but I appreciate your brutal honesty there. And so, what other districts and races should conservatives be paying attention to, not only on the federal level, but I think the state level politics are so interesting as well?
Yeah, so one of the bigger ones, and one of the ones that everybody's talking about here in Texas, is who's going to fill Ken Paxton's shoes, right? So he is the current attorney general for the state of Texas, and he's done a phenomenal job racking up countless wins for conservatives, suing Facebook, suing vaccine manufacturers, suing schools that are doing stuff they shouldn't be doing in schools. And so he's been a phenomenal attorney general, and now he's leading us. And so he's got massive boots to fill. And And so there's a couple people that are getting into the race, maybe even three. One of them that's already announced and racked up a ton of endorsements is State Senator Mays Middleton. And Middleton has quite a bit of money to run his campaign without much outside support. He's gotten a ton of endorsements from politicians and people across the state. You're also going to see two other people that have really close connections and ties to Ken Paxton probably announced here in the next 30 days who haven't officially announced yet.
That's really interesting. And then you know, overall, we're seeing a lot of attention on Texas with border immigration, all of that. How are Governor Greg Abbott's numbers and what he's doing to help the Trump administration enforce the border?
Well, for those who like really, really pay attention to Texas politics and really follow it to a T, Governor Greg Abbott has not been great. He's been usually very reactionary instead of proactive in legislation that helps conservatives and helps this country. One of the bigger things is, like, for example, Texas was sued yesterday for providing in-state tuition for illegal students, for students that are illegals. We've been doing it for over 20 years. The state of Texas has been providing in-state tuition for illegals for at least 20 years. And this was passed, this law to do this was passed by a Republican 20 years ago. And it was defended by Rick Perry, of all people. And, you know, just this last session, Mays Middleton, speaking of, tried to pass a bill to repeal that and get clawbacks and completely stop illegals from getting in-state tuition. And leadership in the Texas House just completely sat on it. It went nowhere. And this is something that Greg Abbott could have led the charge on. This is something that he could have, you know, talked about or even just worked to try to get it repealed. And he's done nothing. It took the Trump administration suing the state of Texas for them to finally be like, okay, you know what, we probably shouldn't provide in-state tuition for illegal aliens. And so Greg Abbott's another one that's been leading, you know, by a position of weakness. But unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess, for Greg Abbott, you know, he's just got the numbers and he's got the money. And, you know, if you're somebody that doesn't really pay attention to politics, he seems like he's doing a great job.
And, you know, I agree with you completely about Governor Greg Abbott. And this is why, you know, longtime listeners will recall that just in my personal capacity, I had endorsed Don Huffines for governor because I think he would have been a better conservative governor for Texas. And I'm glad to see that, you know, Greg Abbott is at least stepping up in, you know, some of the ways that he is, but a lot of work to do. And so I'm speaking with Tony Ortiz, who is the founder of Current Revolt. And, you know, there's a lot of there are a lot of people who are suggesting that, you know, Texas is on the brink of possibly trending blue. We've seen, you know, thankfully that Beta O'Rourke has not successfully, you know, done anything in the state of Texas. We've seen that a lot of Democrats have failed. But then you have, you know, the ones like Jasmine Crockett and others in some of those districts. But in terms of just the overall demographic and where Texas is going, how do you see the 2026 midterms?
Yeah, I think it'll be strong for Texas. You know, a funny statistic that a lot of people don't realize, especially in the Beto O'Rourke season, we found statistically, and the numbers showed this, that Texas immigrants, and I mean people that aren't naturally from Texas, people that have been moved, citizens that have moved here, actually tended to vote more Republican than Texans that have been here their entire life. Actually, Texans that have been here their entire life tended to vote more moderate or Democrat. So I'm pretty hopeful. They've said forever that Texas is turning blue. I think that we're becoming a very expensive state to live in, especially in the major cities like Dallas, Houston, Austin, et cetera. And I think that people that can't afford to move here and want to move here do realize that and do have the intelligence to realize that they're leaving their states like California and New York and these other blue states to come here to, you know, and then benefit from conservative and Republican legislation.
Yeah. And so for a lot of our listeners who are from Texas and who are, you know, very invested in Texas, being conservative, staying conservative, what's your best advice in terms of what to pay attention to over the next year and a half or so until the midterms?
Yeah, I think it's very hard to find good quality conservative Texas news if you're a Texas citizen, right? There are about three or four rags in the state of Texas that provide conservative leaning news. We're one of them, right? But the rest are all lefty and left leaning. And so if you're a citizen trying to pay attention to what's really going on in Texas, you really have to kind of hunt for real news that doesn't have a moderate or leftist swing. But citizens should pay attention to voting records and how politicians actually vote and what they do versus what they say. So what a politician says on Twitter or X and what a video clips they clip and they put on X is completely different than their actions on how they vote. I'll give you an example. One of the strongest, most social media savvy conservatives in the Republican arena as a conservative in the Texas State House actually worked with Democrats and Dade Phelan to pass an LGBTQ bill.
Yeah,
and nobody realizes that. So people just have to pay attention.
Yeah, and that's such good advice, Tony Ortiz, founder of Current Revolt, that you got to pay attention to the voting record and the action, not just the political messaging. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
The month of June has been hijacked by the anti-Christian culture to show their pride in something God calls an abomination. When you support AFR, you help us continue to stand for godly values and provide the resources for you to stay in the know about the enemy's tactics. To say thank you for your gift this month, we'll give you the booklet, Inside the LGBTQ Push of the 1990s, to help strengthen your convictions. Just go to afr.net/offers. afr.net/offers.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And, you know, once in a while, a book comes along from a really excellent author that is just so timely and so perfect that we need to talk about it even more. And of course, I'm talking about my good friend Josh Hammer's new book, Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West. This intertwines. Josh, of course, is Jewish. He also understands very much the political framework, is very much focused on a biblical worldview, and is also the syndicated columnist and senior editor at large at Newsweek and host of the Josh Hammer Show. So I think, you know, a lot of these different angles come in to a very timely piece of this book, especially when you have the current headlines about the rampant anti-Semitism with that horrendous terror attack Sunday in Boulder, Colorado. When you look at the rise of anti-Semitism over the last 2 years since October 7th and that terror attack on campuses around the United States, when you look at the relationship between a lot of the younger MAGA say, we need to be America first, and how can we be pro-Israel if we're America first and really don't understand all of that? Everything going on in the Middle East and that conflict, all of this makes this book so timely. The destiny of the West, I think, is really the critical piece of this. So, Josh, I really appreciate you joining this morning, and I want to talk more about your book because I think it is so timely.
Jen, I really appreciate all the warm and very nice and friendly words. You're a great friend and a great supporter of the Jewish people and the Jewish state. So thank you so much.
Thank you. As a Christian, I absolutely believe that in the biblical covenants between God and Israel, and, you know, and support that in my personal life, but also I think that outflows to policy, and listeners well know that, of course, our worldview and our religious views necessarily should impact our policy views. And so when we're talking about Israel and civilization, you've mentioned on the show previously kind of the inception of this book and why you wrote this. And so I want to go a little deeper into it and the destiny of the West in the sense and the context of the current headlines, because I think we are at a point where, as Representative Chip Roy just said literally this week on the House floor, that we're seeing the Muslim religion basically overtaking a lot of Europe and is really causing a lot of problems in the West. We're seeing the rise of the religion of the LGBTQ mafia that is adamantly opposed to anything that is Judeo-Christian in history or philosophy. And so where do you see us right now in terms of where the destiny of the West is being shaped?
Look, there are so many different reasons as to why Americans, any American of good faith, but perhaps above all Americans of actual faith, Jewish and Christian. I mean, there are so many reasons why we should all support the state of Israel there. But I mean, just focusing on Islam for a second, holding aside kind of theology and just general kind of cultural affinity between the two biblical religions, Judaism and Christianity. I talk at great length, Jenna, as you know, in this book, Israel and Civilization, just about how Jews and Christians, while we of course disagree on some pretty important issues, we have so much more in common than what separates us. You know, so many great Christian Americans throughout American history, from George Washington to Abraham Lincoln, repeatedly citing the Hebrew Bible and really just placing a huge point of emphasis on the Old Testament scripture as guiding their statesmanship. So I talk about this at great length in the book, but focusing just for a second on some more kind of realpolitik, more current political and circumstantial reasons. Yes, I mean, let's not over-intellectualize this. You know, Occam's razor, the simplest explanation is oftentimes the most compelling one. In this case, yeah, Israel is the West man on the spot when it comes to pushing back against Islamism, when it comes to pushing back against radical Islamic jihad. Congressman Roy actually talking about what's happening across the streets of Europe. Heck, what's increasingly happening, Jenna, I hate to say, in way too many jurisdictions in America. We saw this whole controversy in East Plano in the North Dallas suburb about this planned Sharia law Muslim community. I mean, anyone who spends any time in places like Dearborn, Michigan, Hamtramck, Michigan, the Somali community in Minneapolis, Minnesota, there are many radical elements right here in the United States at this time there. And when it comes to trying to turn back the tide here, and especially trying to turn back the tide against literal jihadists, and in a way that ideally would allow the United States to not get as directly involved itself, which is a key kind of America first realist foreign policy thing that I talk about also in great length in the book there. The key here is to essentially hand off the baton to Israel to allow them to take care of the dirty work on all of our behalf. Israel last year killed terrorists like Yahya Sinwar, the October 7th mastermind. They killed Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, for 3+ decades. These are not just enemies of Israel. These are the leaders of U.S.-recognized foreign terrorist organizations. Israel is literally taking out these terrible people on all of our behalf. They don't even necessarily ask to be praised for it. They simply ask to not be thrown under the bus for it. It's really not asking a whole lot, frankly.
Yeah, wow. And you know, this just goes to further show, I think, why the United States needs to have a comprehensive view, not just in this moment and not just in the aftermath of October 7th, but comprehensively a view of the West that is truthful and a view of supporting Israel that's truthful as well. And so where do you see the Trump administration currently, and not just Donald Trump himself, but you know, Marco Rubio is the Secretary of State, and you know, some of these other cabinet officials and even staffers that inform those administrative decisions?
Look, there's clearly a war going on. There's no reason to beat around the bush. There is clearly a war going on within the broader Republican Party, within the broader conservative movement, and to no small extent, I think, within the Trump administration itself, when it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to the Middle East, in some ways, maybe when it comes to the issue of Israel and U.S.-Israel relations. Now, the good news, Jenna, is that the overwhelming majority of registered Republicans, of people who identify as politically conservative, do strongly support U.S.-Israel relations. It gets a little dicier with the younger Gen Z demographic, 18 to 29, and that's definitely one of the reasons why I decided to write this book in the first place. But within the administration in general, look, I mean, on the one hand, you kind of have a pro-Israel dream team, right? I mean, people like Marco Rubio at State, Pete Hegseth at Defense, Mike Huckabee, my goodness. I mean, what a perfect pick for U.S. ambassador to Israel there. No doubt about that. On the other hand, it does seem that the so-called Tucker Carlson wing of the movement of the party is in some ways ascendant. And, you know, Tucker Carlson's son Buckley actually works in the vice president's office. So there are some real reasons to potentially be concerned. Certainly some of the not top staffers at the Pentagon, because Pete Hegseth, I think, is very trustworthy on these topics. But some of the second-level staffers, some of these undersecretaries, seem to come from the Koch brothers' orbit, which tends to be much more skeptical and hostile of U.S.-Israel relations and things like that. So there's a real war playing out. There is a genuine issue coming out there. But, you know, Donald Trump, Jenna, in many ways, his track record really still speaks for itself. And there are some reasons to be concerned. I think his Middle East trip that he completed a few weeks ago definitely had some things that left me kind of interested in more, I guess would be a polite way of saying it. I was not in love with the whole bromance with the Emir of Qatar, for instance. Qatar is an infamous Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas-funding state. I was not a fan of that. So in some ways, I would prefer for Donald Trump to go back to his very simple first-term foreign policy, which was just emboldening your allies like Israel and punishing your enemies like Iran, a very simple, straightforward, and effective policy. But the overall trajectory, the overall track record is still very strong. Netanyahu was the only foreign leader who has visited the White House multiple times since Trump retook the Oval Office. That's a very important thing that we should not quickly forget there. So I remain optimistic, but definitely sober and aware of the threats that we're currently facing.
I'm speaking with Josh Hammer, who is a syndicated columnist, senior editor at large at Newsweek, and also his book is out now, Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and Destiny of the West. And you can get that at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold. And we're talking about this book in the context of the current headlines, and that's what makes this book so timely as well. And you mentioned, Josh, you know, the kind of Tucker Carlson wing of MAGA, and then, you know, how this is really kind of butting heads, I think, with the better view, I would say, of like the Mike Huckabees. And so let's talk about that for a moment. Where do you see the opposition within the overall conservative base? It, obviously MAGA, but then even a little more broadly, the overall conservative base.
Look, Jenna, I don't mince words in the book. I mean, I'm not someone who pulls punches, as you know. You've known me for years now. So, I call out Candace Owens repeatedly in this book. I call out Tucker Carlson repeatedly as well in this book. And that brings me no joy, by the way. I was a former guest on Tucker Carlson's Fox News show. He actually was personally quite kind to me in our interactions over the years. So it brings me no particular joy to see what has become of Tucker Carlson over the past two-ish years or so. But I am very worried about this view, not just of U.S.-Israel relations, Jenna, but what I really think is going on here. And this is where I think it starts to get really, really dangerous and where people like you are so important in trying to hold this whole thing together. Where it starts to get really dangerous is, I think, in its most insidious, in its absolute most insidious, I think you have some truly bad faith actors that are actually trying to convince young Christians to abandon the Jews, to essentially abandon the Jewish people and the Jewish state itself. That is really, really dangerous stuff. And it's also pretty unprecedented in American history. America is quite different from virtually every other country that has existed for many reasons. Among those reasons is that the type of Christianity that has always flourished in this fertile soil is a distinctly Old Testament-heavy philo-Semitic strand of Christianity. I talk about this repeatedly in the book. I mean, George Washington spoke beautifully to the largest Jewish congregation in the country in Newport, Rhode Island, speaking about how he hoped that the children of the stock of Abraham shall always dwell in their own vine and fig tree and shall never be afraid. Alexander Hamilton has this amazing quote where he essentially says that he knows that God exists because the Jewish people, unlike any other nation from 3,000 to 4,000 years ago, they're the only ones who are still alive today. Abraham Lincoln speaks of Americans as an almost chosen people. He repeatedly cites the Hebrew Bible in his speeches there. So, you know, this new kind of Jewish skeptical stuff, for lack of a better description there, it's really foreign. It is not part of America. It's almost kind of a foreign import, which raises all sorts of its own questions about whether any of this is being funded by potential foreign sources there. We know Qatar is pulling a lot of the strings right now, which is a very nefarious actor. So it definitely troublesome stuff. But again, Right now, the administration has some of the most pro-Israel people, pro-Jewish people in the world. Marco Rubio just last week had an amazing statement when it comes to standing against anti-Semitism. And perhaps most importantly, Jenna, when it comes to the actual literal anti-Semitism exploding on our streets, this horrific Molotov cocktail, flamethrower assault in Boulder, the tragic Israeli embassy assassination that happened a couple weeks ago, when it comes to this, This DOJ, you know, and especially this DOJ Civil Rights Division, led by folks like Harmeet Dhillon, Leo Terrell, who's a wonderful man, I've known him for years. He's leading the anti-Semitism task force there. They're taking the job very, very, very seriously. So there is a real war playing out when it comes to foreign policy, and I definitely have my preference as to which way that war unfolds. When it comes to this administration protecting Jews and the Jewish people and synagogues and so forth here on the home front, there is definitely little doubt as to where they stand.
And that's really good to hear. And I'm also glad to hear, Josh Hammer, that, you know, you do call a spade, and you're right. I have known you for years, and I wouldn't have not ever expected anything different. And I think that that's a good model for true conservatives, is that it's not about, you know, loyalty to a person, a party, even a specific platform. It's all about calling out the truth and where people, even friends, are in error, then, you know, you call that out because the principle matters. And so in just the last few minutes we have here with you, and you can follow Josh Hammer at Josh_Hammer on X. I'd encourage you to do that and get the book Israel and Civilization that is available now. Where are we headed with the future of the fate of the West? I mean, not just the current couple of years of the Trump administration, but kind of moving forward into what will be a very interesting, I think, new GOP post-Trump?
Well, a part of the script remains to be unwritten, which is, you know, frankly, why I do things like write books, and why you do things, why we host shows. I mean, we're trying to impact the way that this goes, right? I remain cautiously optimistic. I definitely do. There are some very, very real forces out there working against us. But let's kind of circle back to where we began this conversation, talking about Islam and Sharia supremacism. You know, Jenna, I was giving a speech in Washington, D.C. last summer on all these topics, Middle East, U.S.-Israel relations, and so forth. And there was someone in the back nodding vigorously along to my speech, like aggressively nodding. And he comes up afterwards and says, hi, this guy whose name I'm blanking on, he was born and raised in Tehran. His family fled to America when he was 16 years old, give or take. And he told me that in the Iran state schools in Tehran, their version of the Pledge of Allegiance is they get up, they put their hand on the heart, and they say, I solemnly vow to do all that I can today to destroy the little Satan of Israel and the big Satan of America. They actually believe that. They actually act on it. They've been killing Americans since the hostage crisis that spawned the regime and ended the Jimmy Carter presidency in 1979. So if there's anything that I think is best capable of holding this coalition together, I think the fact that our enemies are real, they are manifold, and unfortunately, they are really evil there. So I think that the fact that these enemies are just not going away anytime soon, Jenna, in some ways, that's actually a weird silver lining, because I think it's going to help keep this coalition together.
Well, you're right that we definitely do want to influence the direction that this goes, and that is why, for yet another reason, this book is so important, and the work that you do is so important, and the work that we do here at American Family Radio Network is also incredibly important. So again, the book is Israel and Civilization by my good friend Josh Hammer. You can follow him on X, Josh_Hammer, and get Israel and Civilization. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. From anywhere books are sold, and we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the morning. This June 24th marks 3 years since Roe v. Wade was overturned. But here's what you may not know. Abortion numbers have surged to a 10-year high. The battleground has shifted from the courtroom to our homes. Today, over 60% of abortions happen through the abortion pill, taken in silence and often alone. Preborn Network clinics are standing in the gap, meeting women in their most desperate hour. And here's what they're seeing. Young mothers, terrified and misled, are delivering their babies, tiny, perfectly formed, onto bathroom floors. These precious babies, once called just tissue, now are lifeless. 11% of these women who take the abortion pill will suffer serious health complications. Countless others carry emotional scars for a lifetime. When you give to preborn, you're not just saving a baby, you're saving a mother as well. You're giving her hope, financial support, and the truth. Preborn has already rescued over 350,000 babies, but there are so many more who need our help. Your tax-deductible gift makes this mission possible. To donate now, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And finally today, you may have heard the controversy or the controversy over BarkBox. And for those of you who don't know what BarkBox is, you definitely know my two dogs, Todd and Copper, and how much they love their toys and treats like any good doggos do. And we have a subscription to BarkBox, which is a monthly curated themed box that gives you two toys and two bags of treats and provides joy and wonderment for all of the little doggies out there. And we've had that subscription really since I got the dog. So it's been almost 2 years now, because yes, their birthday, they'll be two next month, and you can wish them a happy birthday now if you'd like. But anyway, we get this box, and they're really cute toys, and they always have a theme, and, you know, it's something like Valentine's Day, it's like macaroons and roses, and then there's like a theme of, you know, fast food or backyard barbecue or like, you know, whatever, and they're always really cute and a good thing. Well, I get text messages from them talking about add-ons or, you know, other boxes and things that you can purchase, and for Pride Month, of course, it's, hey, we have all of these Pride-themed toys, which you have to ask yourself, really, for dogs, do they need something that is called a loud, proud cloud? I don't even know what in the world LGBTQ Pride has to do with a cloud that has, like, a rainbow coming out of its mouth. I mean, this is just a bizarre toy, regardless of anything else. This is just something that is so stupid, frankly. But obviously, you know, dogs aren't the ones that this is curated for. It is obviously for the owners. And so because of Pride Month and because of my sincerely held religious beliefs, I contacted customer service and I said, you know, I disagree with the whole Pride thing. I don't think you guys should be doing this. And I would like to opt out of my June BarkBox because I don't want any Pride themed toys and all of that. They didn't give me an alternative. They didn't say, you know, these are only add-ons, whatever. Customer service is very nice. Just said, sure, we'll go ahead and skip that month. We respect that viewpoint, and we'll go ahead and just start you back up in July. Okay, great. You know, no problem. So I posted this on my X feed, and it always cracks me up, frankly, the things that get attention on X, because out of all things that Newsweek would want to talk about, I get an email from a reporter saying, hey, we saw your post about opting out of the Pride Month box, and we're really curious about this. Would you like to give us a comment? So this became the headline: Ex-Trump lawyer pauses BarkBox over Pride theme. And it goes on to say, Jenna Ellis, who once served as a lawyer for President Donald Trump, said she paused her BarkBox subscription over its Pride Month collection, highlighting the ongoing debate about how businesses should approach consumers' diverging views on LGBTQ plus and Pride. Newsweek also reached out to BarkBox for comment via email. And they're saying that it matters because as Pride Month kicked off June 1st, we're seeing that President Trump has basically canceled it. He is suggesting, of course, that we celebrate other things like military veterans and, you know, things that actually matter to America. And we're also seeing that a lot of companies are not pushing the Pride theme nearly as much as they have been in the last few years, especially during the Biden administration, but even previously in Trump's first administration. If you've seen the win over Target, where there are a lot of stores now that instead of this giant Pride themed display in the middle of their store, they're actually putting out America, and they have, you know, American flag themed merchandise, USA, all of this, which, yes, is not a political message. It's also not an agenda. It's actually something that all Americans can coalesce around and celebrate because, hey, we're all Americans. And it also cracks me up that some of the left is so triggered by the American flag. And I'm thinking, okay, then, you know, do you want to move to Iran? Do you want to, you know, move to a different country and have a different flag? Well, they hail from the land of the rainbow, probably. You know, they have a flag and they have a pin, and it's almost like a national identity to them, which is just so ridiculous. But it does matter, I think, according to Newsweek, because this has been a decades-long battle between not just, you know, for rights and what civil rights mean and what natural rights mean, as we've talked about on this program, but really it's a battle for truth. It's a battle to say that, yes, there are only two genders. No, you cannot change your gender. It doesn't matter how much you mutilate your body. It doesn't matter how much hormone therapy you give yourself or you foist upon your innocent children. This is an immutable characteristic that God himself ordained. And even if you don't believe in God, well, too bad. The laws of the universe and God the creator God still is deciding those things for you. As human beings, we are confined to the reality to which we are presented. And as much as you may not like that reality, sorry, you're not God. Sorry, there are things that you simply, by virtue of being a human being, cannot change. There are things that are outside of legislative control. They're outside the power of man. We can, at times, negotiate within our reality. We can, the eternal example I always give is that we can fly in spite of gravity, but it's not because we have legislated our way out of gravity. We've repealed the law of gravity. No, it's that we've learned how it works in the laws of nature and of nature's God, and then we have negotiated within that reality in order to overcome that and be able to fly. So there are ways that we can navigate our reality, but we have to approach it truthfully. Because imagine if an engineer who's designing an airplane is denying the law of gravity and saying, well, it doesn't exist, and so we can design an aircraft that will fly in the reality or the supposed reality that gravity is repealed. Well, that wouldn't go very well, right? So you have to first view reality clearly, truthfully, and then you can navigate and negotiate within that confine and within the contours of the reality to which we're presented. So this whole battle is really, as my good friend Steve Dace says, it's a different worldview. It is a different religion, ultimately, because a religion that expressly denies reality is ultimately denying God. And so this isn't just a matter of, well, we're going to coexist, we're going to live and let live, and, you know, hey, you know, if I don't want someone telling me what religion I can practice, then I can't, you know, put any sort of religious parameters on anyone else. I can't codify my faith. We can't legislate morality. That all is a bunch of nonsense. And a lot of argumentation that, unfortunately, the left has convinced a lot of Christians of, so that we will not continue to legislate according to the confines of reality and truth, and we will allow the left to continue to live in their twisted, perverted, arbitrary reality, and they're going to try to codify that. I mean, look at what we're doing with all of the LGBTQ nonsense. I mean, there are cases currently pending in front of the U.S. Supreme Court that deal with these topics, that deal with teaching children as young as kindergarten age that you can change your biological reality, that you can change your gender. So when they're telling us you can't legislate your morality and your Christian faith shouldn't come into the public square, they're telling you that while simultaneously trying to codify their religion and their view of reality. So they're not even playing by the same rules that they're trying to foist on you. And one of my favorite responses to people saying, well, you know, God disapproves of you, of this, Jenna, you know, you shouldn't have posted that. That's too, you know, whatever. My favorite response is, how do you know what the God that you don't even believe in requires of me? Right? Like, it's utterly ridiculous. And I just live by the principle that I don't take advice or criticism from anybody who I don't trust to have reality in mind. I don't take criticism from someone I wouldn't take advice from. That's just a principle on which I live my life, and I don't really care what the haters say because the haters don't live in reality anyway. So this has been a decades-long battle. It will continue to persist. And then there, once in a while, some little expression of this that in the grand scheme of things probably doesn't really matter, but it's just the next iteration of trying to embed all of this ridiculous LGBTQ nonsense into our private lives like BarkBox, right? So this matters. And I said, and I told Newsweek that, customers shouldn't have to choose between their conscience and a box of dog toys. And so when companies push a political or ideological message, they risk losing customers who simply want the product, not to advance an agenda. Opting out is about conviction. And so for many faith communities, Pride Month pushes an agenda that demands affirmation, demands engagement at the expense of our beliefs and traditional moral values. And so companies that choose to promote Pride Month are no longer just selling products, they're promoting worldviews. So I went on to tell Newsweek, and if inclusion is supposedly the goal, which obviously not really, otherwise they would have an Easter, Christian-themed BarkBox. That never happens. I wonder why. But if inclusion is supposedly the goal, why is it only extended to the LGBTQ community? Why not celebrate Christian faith, military families, adoption, traditional values, like all of these other things, and groups that actually do make up a larger percentage of their consumer base? Because the people who identify as LGBTQ are like such a minuscule percentage of the population. And yet, because of the left's agenda, they are trying purposefully to cater to them, not because they actually care about the outrage or the backlash, but because it promulgates the ideology and the outcome and the policy and the reality that they prefer. So it's not about inclusion. It's forcing selective virtue signaling. So we don't need dog toys that are like a loud and proud cloud, whatever. I mean, and you can go to BarkBox and look at the ridiculous toys that they have. I mean, these aren't even like, I'm thinking if I were like somebody who, promoted the six colored rainbow nonsense mafia, I'd be looking at these dog toys thinking, really, that's like the best that you're giving me as a consumer? Like, I'd be offended in that way, right? But it's ridiculous. And dogs don't need pride toys, and their owners certainly don't need them. But then I thought, okay, it's done and that's it. Well, after this, then a few days ago, there was an internal Slack message that apparently the leadership or an employee of BarkBox had posted in their internal Slack, if you know that's like a messaging app. And that got posted to a Reddit thread and then kind of went viral on social media, including X. And this is what it said. After some thoughtful discussion today with leadership, this is BarkBox talking, we've made the decision to pause all paid ads and life cycle marketing pushes for the Pride kit effective immediately. While celebrating Pride is something we may value, we need to acknowledge that the current climate makes this promotion feel more like a political statement than a universally joyful moment for all dog people. If we wouldn't feel comfortable running a promotion centered around another politically charged symbol, like a MAGA-themed product, it's worth asking whether this is the right moment to run this particular campaign. This isn't about backing away from support. It's about tone and ensuring our marketing remains inclusive and welcoming to everyone in our community. Right now, pushing this promo risks unintentionally sending the message that, quote-unquote, we're not for you, to a large portion of our audience. So a couple things. I think that's well said. I agree with that leadership message. I think it's kind of funny that they're equating a Pride-themed box to a MAGA-themed box. There were a lot of MAGA people and people in the MAGA community, MAGA supporters, that were actually offended by that. And I thought, but that's actually an apt comparison in this sense, not because, MAGA is a ridiculous rainbow mafia like the left, but because of the political nature of those statements. I mean, you can't see the Make America Great Again hat and not recognize that is intentionally and overtly a political message. And so when this leadership Slack text is suggesting that that they're comparing Pride to MAGA, I think that's actually a very apt comparison. It is a political message. So then the left and the Rainbow Mafia gets all offended and they start canceling their BarkBox subscriptions, which is hilarious to me because it's like, this is exactly now what BarkBox is. They're offending both sides of this. And so the CEO then goes yesterday and apologizes on X for the quote unquote disrespectful message, but doesn't actually say that the ad campaigns or any of this is going to resume. So BarkBox has now successfully offended literally everybody because they decided to be political. So my question for the BarkBox CEO is, really? Really? You want to do this? Like, why don't you just disengage all political agenda, all agenda, period. Just go back to making the cute and fluffy little hamburger toys that my dogs love and just stop with all the nonsense, right? That, like, haven't you learned anything from Target? Haven't you learned anything from Bud Light? So, you know, if I'm the tip of the spear of the downfall of BarkBox, and you know, oh well, I'll have to get my toys from elsewhere for my doggos. Have a great weekend. Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.